Singer Joe Williams became famous in 1955 when he recorded the blues song Every Day with the Count Basie Band. By the time Williams joined Basie in 1954, he was already a veteran of the big bands, having sung with Coleman Hawkins, Lionel Hampton, Jimmy Noon, Erskine Tate, and Andy Kirk. Since leaving Basie in 1961, Williams has had a flourishing solo career. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot once wrote, "Williams is two equally accomplished singers. One is the famous blues singer, and the other is the almost unknown ballad singer." Joe Williams will sing blues and ballads tonight in Philadelphia as part of the Mellon Jazz Festival. And on June 23rd at the JVC Festival in New York, he'll team up with the Count Basie Orchestra, under the direction of Frank Foster, for a special program called Every Day with Joe Williams at 70. Before we meet Joe Williams, let's hear a ballad from his new album, In Good Company. This is How Deep is the Ocean, and it features Henry Johnson on guitar.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses are sprinkled with dew? How far would I travel to be where you are? How near is the journey from here to a star? And if I ever lost you, how much would I cry? How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky?
Joe Williams from his new album, In Good Company. Let's talk about how you started singing. Now, you grew up mostly
Chicago.
In Chicago. Your mother was an organist.
Mother played piano.
Oh, piano, okay.
She played piano and sang. Yes.
In the church?
Yeah, sang in the church choir. She didn't play piano in the church. She played at home.
Were you influenced by church music much yourself?
Oh, I loved it, yes. I think the church probably really opened up my ears to classical music as well, because we'd have recitals and concerts and things like that at the church. We used to have theater at the church as well.
So your mother never had any problem with you singing secular music or the pop music of the day?
Oh, no. She used to sing some, too. It wasn't that kind of a household. She used to let me stay awake to listen to Duke Ellington in the 30s broadcast from the Cotton Club, and then kiss me and tuck me in after the band went off. You know, she took me to the theater to see an orchestra there. It was Erskine Tate was conducting the orchestra. And in the band was Louis Armstrong. And I was about 8, 9 years old. And that was one evening, Sunday evening, after church services in the daytime and in the afternoon services, and then we went to the theater. And so she made sure that I heard everything from the Chicago Symphony to the Metropolitan Opera Company coming from New York to all of it.
Do you remember your first time actually singing in front of an audience?
Yes, in front of a band. Yeah, I was nervous, really nervous, too.
What was it? What was the band? What was the
It was a guy named Francois. His name was Francois. He had been in town broadcasting from a club called Dave's Cafe nightly, and he had finished his engagement in this club and played a ballroom on a Sunday afternoon. And he was looking for a singer. And the fellows, my guys, told me, "Oh, Joe, you could, you know, sing with that band, only you're afraid." And I went up and sang. I think I did Dinner for One, Please James, or something like that. And the guy wanted me to go with him. He was going to give me $25 a week to go with him. But I think I was about 15 at the time. My mother said, "Oh, you're going to finish school, dummy." And I said, "Sure."
Did you finish high school before going on the road?
No, in my senior year, I got a job making about $20, $30 a night at a place called Kitty Davis's, Jackson and Wabash. And that kind of money, I think, dissuaded them to let me do what I wanted to do. I said, he's a man child, he's in the street, and he's doing it. Let's see how he does it, you know, if he does it, you know. But I always knew that I had the house to come back to, you know, in case I fell on my face.
Now, I had read about you that when you were a sophomore in high school that doctors found a spot on your lung,
right,
and they collapsed the lung.
Yeah, pneumothorax is called.
Would you explain that?
Pneumothorax?
Uh-huh.
Oh, they puncture, they go between the rib with a needle, and they collapse the lung with gas. I think that's what they did to it now.
And then it got reinflated? No.
Here's what happened. See, while it's collapsed, it's resting.
I see.
And heals. That was the theory, anyway.
What was the practice? What actually happened?
Well, it instead of the spot now, the scar tissue, of course, which might even be stronger than the initial lung itself.
Chicago must have been a terrific place to get started as a singer, because all the bands would pass through there to play, and a lot of the bands came out of Chicago.
Yeah, they all had to come through Chicago to get the stamp, so to speak. You know.
When you were underage, did you find ways to sneak into the clubs to see the bands?
Yes. I was always big for my age anyway. And I was very quiet. And I just wanted to observe. I'd get in a corner someplace and sit down. Club, the owners would come over and sit with me and give me coffee and ice cream and pie and stuff like that, you know. And I'd hear somebody on the stage, and I'd say, oh, gee, I can sing better than that, you know. And they'd say, be quiet and listen, which was good advice. Because you learn many things when you listen. Sometimes you learn what not to do as well.
Singing with a lot of different bands in the 1940s, did you find that the singer had a different role in each band? By that I mean, you know, that in some bands the singers were really important, maybe in other bands they were not considered as necessary. And did the musicians, you were saying the musicians were really supportive of you, were they always that way in the
bands?
Or did they sometimes feel like the singers took attention away from their own musicianship?
I never felt that. Because if you sing like a musical instrument, for instance, you don't try to cover up your support. You sing with the support. In other words, it's a little bit like a drummer. A drummer is supposed to play, just try not to get in the way, is the expression that was used by one drummer, Sonny Greer, who was with the Ellington Orchestra. And try not to get in the way. That's what a drummer's job is for. The music will swing if you try not to get in the way. And the same thing with the singer. You don't get in the way. You're the soloist. So you can punctuate, make a statement, but you don't get in the way of the music itself. And it gives everybody a chance to contribute. You mustn't ever have someone back there, have a section back there feeling, my part is not important, you know. My part is important, and if it's done subtly, you know, then I have to make room for it so that it's heard, and heard the way they want it to be heard.
Singer Joe Williams is my guest, and in the 1950s he sang with Count Basie. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes, and hear the big hit he had with the Basie Band, Every Day I Have the Blues. Williams has a new album out now called In Good Company. In 1948, I think it was, you had a nervous breakdown.
47.
You spent about a year in the hospital?
Yeah, 47, I think it was, yeah.
What were your symptoms, so to speak? What was going on?
Oh, gosh, symptoms now. Well, I didn't want to go out anywhere. I don't think I could get dressed and go out in the street even, you know. Severe depression. And a number of things might have brought it on. But I think it was just trying to decide what I wanted to do, whether I really wanted to do what I was doing or what.
Whether you wanted to sing or not? Or whether you wanted to sing with the bands you were singing with?
Yeah, what I wanted to sing or what I wanted to do with my life, really. I remember seeing Andy Kirk. I was singing with Andy when this, 1946, I guess it was 47. About April of 47, I went in the hospital, it was. And I remember looking at him and saying, my, what an elegant man, you know. And looking around me and seeing these role models that I would like very much to emulate, I thought. And when I realized how they lived and what they did, what have you, I think I began to look inward at myself as opposed to around me, you know. It was like, what is it in Dr. Zhivago? When he was asked, when doctor was asked about living and about dying, he said, well, your consciousness is a light, and, you know, it's like a train going down a track, and it's a light directed to show you where you're going, you know. That's your consciousness. And it's only when you take, when you turn the light inward that you're headed for a wreck, you know.
So what was it about the musicians who had been your role models that made you think again?
Well, just the way they looked, the way they were. Clean living, no dope or anything. They were, to me, they were like pristine, you know, squeaky clean and really super type people. And I said, yeah, that's, I think that's the image I'd like to project, you know, instead of a hip street, you can't do nothing for me but give me some money type cat.
And know? Is that what you'd been before? You
know? Well, no, I'd consider, you, well, you did that as in self-defense.
In self-defense of what?
Huh? Self-defense of what? Well, if you are around people, say women, or men, either one, and you don't have anything to speak of, you know, as a defense of not having anything and being embarrassed because you don't have anything, then you beg all the time or put on the facade that I don't want to be bothered by anybody who can't do anything for me. Either one, you know. That's what that was about. I know that I had a lot of things going on I had to straighten out, you know. I decided whether I wanted to be a $2 pimp or a $100 trick, you know.
So that's...
Yeah, all of these things you had to settle in your mind because you see all these things happening growing up. You see them happening everywhere. You see them happening downtown in the downtown hotels. You know, you see this life going on and you observe it and you see another lifestyle going on. And you got to make a choice which one really appeals to you. Which one did you really like? Did you feel as though you wanted to relate to or be like? You know, and I made that decision back then and shut off everything else. And in the midst of it all, went into a severe depression. Because I used to get high every day, of course, you know. And I stopped that just like that. I stopped that like I stopped smoking cigarettes. One day I was smoking, the next day I wasn't.
You getting high on marijuana?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, oh yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So when you had this big crisis and figured out you had to decide which direction you wanted to head in, did you check yourself into the hospital? Or?
No, my wife put me in the hospital. She checked me into the hospital. And I spent a year in diagnostic. They didn't know what to do with me, really. They had no idea what to do with me, I don't think.
Did you feel like
they
you belonged?
They gave me electric shock and insulin shock. And
electric shock must have been in the really experimental stages in 1947.
Oh, I'm a living experiment from pneumothorax to...
You must have been terrified when you knew you were going to get electroshock therapy.
when you see the people that have had electric shock, then you can have some apprehension. But when you see the other people who've had the treatment, you can become apprehensive.
But you hadn't seen anyone yet, so you didn't know what it was you were supposed to be worrying about.
Yeah, I had no idea. Yeah. You know,
well, what effect did it have on you?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, it knocks you out, for one thing. So I don't know what might have happened during the times that I was knocked out. I have no idea about that. But eventually it stopped. They stopped it. And I don't know. It's I was busy observing people around me in there, you know, like, wow. Some people who'd been there for 25 years and stuff, you know, like that. And I could see how easy that was a trap you could fall into, where the state would take care of you and you eat, you know. Food was good. You know, on Sundays you go to church. You go to choir rehearsals during the week. And they had an orchestra in there, a symphony orchestra, a concert orchestra as well as a dance orchestra. And there was, you know, rehearsals and what have you. And I was working with the band there. And it was quite an experience.
When you got out after spending a year in the hospital, did you know with certainty which direction you wanted your life to head in, which kind of musician you wanted to be?
I knew. I knew very well because I knew before I got out because I had a letter from Andy Kirk saying that we had a recording, we'd done a recording. And he said they wanted to start pushing the recording and wanted me to come back with a band. And he offered me $250 a week. That was 1947. It was. And my wife wouldn't sign me out of the hospital at the time. And so I told her and my mother, I don't care if I see either one of you again, you know. Which brings us maybe to the point of nobody loves me, nobody seems to care. Or at least nobody seems to understand what I'm about. You know, because I said before, for 30 years now, the lady I'm with, I mean, we have a great understanding. You know, she does anything she wants, and I'm supposed to pay for it. You know?
Nobody loves me, nobody seems to care. That's a line from Every Day I Have the Blues.
Yeah.
Which was your big hit with Basie
in 1955. Yeah. But being an only child, you know, and having said to your wife and your mother, you know, like, I don't care if I see either one of you again. Yeah.
But you did see them, your mother, anyway.
Oh, sure. Sure I did, you know.
So you got out of the hospital, played with Andy Kirk for a while.
No, I didn't.
You didn't? Okay, that date never happened.
No, it never happened.
Okay.
Because it was April of 48 before I got out. I went in April of 47 and out in April of 48.
Let me just ask you one more thing about this period. When you got out and you decided that you wanted to be a musician who was...
A free spirit, really.
And to give up alcohol and marijuana?
No, I didn't give up alcohol.
Oh, okay. But,
I didn't smoke any more pot.
Okay.
I mean, I didn't do that anymore, no.
But did you change a lot? I mean, did you change?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think I changed a lot. It was just that I think I'd made up my mind that, yeah, this is what I want to do, and I'm going to do this. You see, what you have to realize is that when you're isolated or when you're in the hospital, you have a lot of time to think. And one of the things you think about, probably something that young ladies think about very early in life, you know, well, what the hell now? I've stopped, and everybody else in the world is going on. You know, suddenly, you know, one day you look up and you've stopped. And everybody else is going, everything else is going on. Just as if you had never been there, right? Now, how do you relate to a world like this, you know? Take it as you find it, that's all. But it really fixes you up pretty good so that you can get through the grease from that point on, you know.
Joe Williams is my guest. Let me skip ahead a few years to when you're singing with Count Basie. This was in, I think, late 1954 that you joined the band? That you
the
actually
day
joined
after
the band?
Christmas.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The day after Christmas of 1954.
Who had been the singer right before you?
Nobody.
He had not had a singer for a few years?
Yeah, that's right.
What made him decide to take you on?
I don't know. He sent for me to come by his hotel in Chicago, and we talked. And he said, I can't give you much or what you're worth, but I can give you something, and why don't you come with me and see what people all over the country think of your work? And as things get better for me, they'll get better for you, you know? And that's all it was. And so he sent me a money order. That was in September. About a week before Christmas, he sent me a money order telegram, and I booked a flight to LaGuardia from Chicago, from Chicago's Midway, and joined the band. And we got together with arrangers named Frank Foster and Ernie Wilkins. And Ernie made Every Day. Frank Foster made The Comeback and All Right, Okay, You Win, and Every Day I'll Fall in Love All Over Again with You, and most of our things. Teach Me Tonight, Ernie Wilkins made, you know.
Let me ask you about the big hit, the first big hit you had with Basie,
yeah.
Every Day. Was it your idea to record this?
Yeah.
Why did you choose it?
Because I like it.
That's a good reason.
Yeah, he was so funny. Basie said, do you know any of Jimmy's things? You know, Jimmy Rushing, who had been with him in the 30s.
Right.
You know, and 30s and the 40s, actually, you know. And I said, no, I don't know any. You don't know none of Jimmy's stuff? I said, no. He said, what do you know? Every Day.
Let me play Every Day.
All right.
And this was recorded in 1955. My guest, Joe Williams, and the Count Basie Orchestra.
Every day. Every day I have the blues. Every day. Every day I have the blues. Well, you see me worry, baby, because it's you I hate to lose. Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care. Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care. Speaking of bad luck and trouble, well, you know I've had my share. I'm gonna back my suitcase, moving on down the line. Oh, I'm gonna back my suitcase, move on down the line. Well, there ain't nobody worrying, and there ain't nobody crying. Seems to me every day, every day I have the blues. Every day, every day, every day I have the blues. You see me worry, baby, 'cause it's you I hate.
Your diction's different when you're singing blues and when you're singing, say, a ballad or a pop standard?
Not really, because if you don't understand the words, you can't, you couldn't enjoy it. I remember when I was singing blues someplace, and Harry Sweets Edison was with me at the time, and he would say, make it plain, and explain it, explain it, you know.
You never had formal vocal training.
No, not really.
As you get older, do you ever wish that you had formal vocal training that would keep your vocal cords in as good shape as possible, or do you know all that stuff anyways?
Know all what stuff?
About how to sing so that it doesn't hurt your vocal cords.
I guess I know. I don't know.
I mean, your voice is in, you know, great shape.
I guess I know, yeah. I was wondering why, you know.
Why is she asking me this?
Yeah.
I've just met a lot of singers who didn't have vocal training and who at some point in their career go to a teacher or wish that they had because there's just so much stress that's put on their throat.
Yeah, no, I don't put any stress on me. Stress? I went through all that early. I got rid of all that in 1947. All the stress. Yeah, to do anything that's stressful now, nothing.
Can I ask you one last question?
What?
I notice you're wearing a Jewish star.
That's on one side. On the other side is St. Genesius.
Oh.
The words guide my career.
Uh-huh. What words are those?
Guide my career.
Oh, guide my career. Oh, okay.
Yeah. My wife gave me that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
She's Jewish, or?
No. We just don't take any chances.
I guess that's a good attitude.
Yeah, no.
Joe Williams, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Okay, Terry.